You're listening to Love and Revolution Radio, covering the heart of change and changes of the heart, featuring stories of ordinary, extraordinary people who are waging struggles for love and revolution.
This week on Love and Revolution Radio, we're taking a moment for reflection and exploration, covering strategy for nonviolent movements and a few key dynamics, practices, and understandings you can use in your own work to make change.
One of the most beautiful stories that came out of the protests up in Rexton, in New Brunswick, and Elsie Buchdick was that one of the drivers of the thumper trucks actually went to the Mi'kmaq people that were there and the Maliseet people that were there protesting, and there had been incredible conflict and confrontation between these two groups. And he came to them and he said, "I don't want to hurt you." And he cried and he said, "This is the only thing I know how to do. It's the only way I know how to support my family. If you would show me another way, I would do it because I don't want to hurt anybody." And so when you speak to the heart of the people about the destruction and the harm that is being done by their industry, and you try to help them understand, we're standing here because we love your children as much as we love our own. You speak to the hearts and the minds of those people, then you can create a shift within them. Hello, this is Sherry Mitchell for Love and Revolution Radio. Aguanu, welcome to you in my native language. I'm coming to you from my home in the Dawnland, in Bunawabskeg territory, in and along the shores of the beautiful Penobscot River in central Maine. And as always, I'm joined by my ever-radiant, ever-wonderful co-host, Miss Rivera Sun. Hello, Rivera.
Greetings, Sherry. You know, the solstice is past, the energy is rising. You can feel the activity level for being fertile and fermenting all across the country right now. And that's inspiring me to dig into how we make change on a real strategic level. This is our review and reflection show. We've had a number of incredible guests in the past 8 weeks, and again the theme has circled around of how do we use strategy, and what is strategy as we're thinking about making change? There's many ways to approach it. There are people who do community building, people who do reconciliation work, people who work with youth. One of the things that you and I do, which I think is a wonderful thing to share with our listeners on this review and reflection show, is we think about the unique dynamics of nonviolent struggle or making change through nonviolent action. And I'd love us to dig into that subject today on Love and Revolution Radio so that everyone who's listening gets a chance to connect with some insights and skills and knowledge for doing this work in their own communities where they live.
That's right. And I think that that's maybe one of the things that often gets somewhat overshadowed by the other wonderful and amazing guests that we have is the fact that you and I also do some pretty remarkable work out in the world that we are very committed to and feel very passionate about. And that work involves helping to address the issues of building nonviolent strategies for addressing these issues that we're facing, because these are no small issues that we're facing. And if we hope to be effective, we have to have a really concrete strategy in order to address those things, and it has to be multidimensional. And one of the most exciting things about today for me is being able to be in the space with you again. We haven't been in the space for nearly a year now, where we're able to share and collaborate and cooperate to bring forth this image of how we address these issues in a way that's actually effective, because there are a lot of people that are inspired to create change. They're motivated by deep emotion to create change. There's a sense of urgency that people are feeling in their bodies, in their spirits, that's prompting them to make change, but they don't know how to make that change. And so hopefully today we'll be able to give people some concrete strategies on how to look at change from a multidimensional level and to be able to start incorporating these practices into your daily lives and into the movements that you're a part of.
That's right. And let's invoke the lineage a little bit. It's important for us to realize that we are the luckiest human beings ever to have lived. Now that sounds a little odd given the challenges that we face in our world today, but we're fortunate because nonviolence is not a mystery. It is a mysterious and largely unplumbed field in all of its dimensions, but we are not operating 100 years ago or 1,000 years ago in terms of our understanding of what this word nonviolence means, and particularly what nonviolent action is and how it works. We have had literally thousands of nonviolent movements and actions and campaigns happening around the globe. Nonviolence comes to us from a global lineage of all people of all genders, races, classes, ethnicities, cultures, faiths, and backgrounds. And that's very important to understand, that when we speak about nonviolent action, we are honoring all of those people who have lived and organized and struggled and sometimes died and often succeeded and made mistakes and made very wise strategies. All of this comes to us now today as a gift to humanity. And it's our job and our responsibility to learn as much about it as we can. So I want to honor those, the millions of people around the world who have experimented with this field of nonviolent action and brought us to our conversation today.
For me, one of those principal characters was Daganoweda, who was the legendary peacemaker of the Haudenosaunee. And he traveled during a time of war to each of the five Iroquois nations to convince each nation to join him in a treaty of peace. And the Gayanashagoa, which is the great law of peace, spun out of that. And so we have all of these well-known and not-so-well-known figures throughout history who have paved a way for us to be able to sit here today and to have this conversation and to be able to honor them and to acknowledge their contributions to our global evolution is really beautiful and meaningful for me, and I'm sure for you as well, Rivera.
I agree, and I think that's one of the important things about understanding the lineage of nonviolence, that most of us in our ethnic or cultural backgrounds have both sides of the human coin. We have oppressors and oppressed. We have violent characters and we have nonviolent characters. We need to understand both sides of our human equation. For me, knowing the origins of the word boycott was very important because I come from Irish ancestors, and to know that the Irish contributed the word boycott, and that we all have these stories in our history and we need to know them and pick them up as a way forward from the place that we are today. So Sherry, why don't you kick us off with some of just the nuts and bolts, the very basic concepts about nonviolent action and nonviolent movements?
Well, I think the first thing that people need to recognize is that there needs to be an organized campaign. There needs to be some type of strategy with goals, themes, and specific actions that are leading toward an ultimate goal. And people need to be clear about what that ultimate goal is. We oftentimes have people that come together that have numerous reasons for coming together. They have been triggered by an event in an individualized way, and they come together and they join with this body of people who are also triggered by that event. But it may not be that they have the same types of interests in addressing the issue in the same type of way. So it's good for us to be able to stand in solidarity with those who are also being triggered by these events, but we have to understand that there are a number of different types of interests that come to play when we come together in those ways. In my workshops, I talk about Derrick Bell, who was a preeminent civil rights scholar, who wrote about the interest convergence dilemma, saying that the majority will never concede any point to the minority unless it's in their best interest to do so. And so when we start looking at that, we have to start looking at where do our interests converge and what are the interests that we're bringing. There are three primary type of interests that we often talk about, which are process, substantive, and emotional. And each one of those can be dissected, and we can start looking at how those interests can actually help frame the movement. They can demonstrate understanding amongst disparate groups of people. They can generate options for addressing the situation at hand. They can evaluate possible solutions, help to refocus the group, help to bring together this collective creative intelligence to address the situation in a way that actually honors all parties moving forward. And I think we're going to get into that later, the yes and dynamics of creating a really inclusive movement. And so we need to be willing to look at all of those things, to look at how we address those things. We have to be willing to be committed to creating the change, because when we want to change something, it's often attached to a larger system, whether that is a formal system or an informal system operating from within the society. And in order to be able to do that, we have to be able to understand what holds that system in place. What are the things that we're contributing to the maintenance of that system? How do we effectively disengage our power and our energy from that system to allow it to naturally dissolve, to end its natural life cycle so that we can evolve into something new? And there are very specific strategies that we teach in our workshops that address some of those issues. And I know that you look at that from a general systems theory, and that you probably have a lot to add to that.
I do, Sherry, and that's such a key and important point. Two things that I'd really like to highlight from what you said, or maybe even three things. One, that a movement is more than a single action, that in terms of strategy, actions make up campaigns, and the campaigns build into a series of stepping stones to achieve the goals of the movement. And this is really crucial because many of us are caught in the cycle of simply reacting and doing street demonstrations or single actions whenever we're outraged about something. And this is a good way to protest and to remove your consent that's based on silence. But it's not enough to actually make the change that we're seeking. We need to go deeper. We need to think strategically. And when we are thinking strategically, it is important to realize that we actually are asking for a number of people to change. We're asking for the oppressor or the perpetrator or the problem person to make a change. Or we're asking for a system to change its structure. And especially, we're asking ourselves and our colleagues and our friends and our neighbors and communities to make a change. That from a general systems perspective, and from an understanding that comes from Gene Sharp about how power works, that power is not a top-down phenomenon, even though we're taught that it works that way all the time. A power holder, let's say a dictator, relies on the consent and cooperation of millions and millions of people. And if nobody will do what the dictator wants to have done, then he's just a little man in a room throwing a tantrum. Unless people like you and me agree to carry out the orders, or we supply the resources that the power holder needs, or we give them our skills and knowledge, or we show up and we do our jobs. That basically a problem, an injustice, a power holder, a dictator, whatever you want to put in that concept, cannot rule, cannot have power unless someone does what they're told. When we withdraw our consent and cooperation, it does not work anymore. This is a critical understanding for this whole discussion of how nonviolent struggle works, and it's rooted in general systems theory, which is basically the idea that we are an interconnected web and that we are participant in the systems, whether they're just or unjust. So when we're looking at change, we need to ask, how can we, our opposition, our friends and neighbors, the bystanders in our community, start to change how we're participating in this system of injustice and remove that cooperation and consent as a leverage point of making change?
I think that's really important because one of the things that I've been writing about recently is looking at our common agreements and social contracts. what are the common agreements that we have held throughout history? And certainly one of those common agreements has been the ideology around conquest. And we have even incorporated this conquest ideology into our activism. It's about toppling and dominating. And we've talked about that previously on the show. And I think that we also have to understand what are our common agreements around the systems that we're working within that are causing us such pain and frustration and that are opposed to the direction that we claim to want to go in. And one of the areas where I see real conflict with that is this practice of getting arrested. Now, there are specific times, which I'm hoping you'll talk about after, when an arrest is a really positive and proper way to engage the process of change. But I have heard so many people talking about being arrested. And when I ask them, well, what was the purpose of your arrest? Well, we wanted to make a point and we wanted to educate people. Okay, and how did that move your movement forward? Well, you know, a half dozen people on the street took our pamphlets and we were helping to enlighten them. Well, that's wonderful. So how did it actually change the system? How did it actually change the policies? How did it actually change the common agreements that we have within our societies that uphold these systems? When you think about the issue of arrest and hundreds of people being arrested in DC, and I admire and I honor their courage. However, when you have a group of people standing up who are able to get arrested and then get bailed out and then go on with their lives in order to illustrate a point, and you have a young Black woman who gets pulled over for a turn signal and ends up dead in prison or in jail. You have a Black man on the street who's choked to death for having cigarettes that he's giving to somebody else. You have Native men and women across the country who go into the police system and never come out alive. And so when you start talking about these issues and you're disconnected from the long-term outcome of what your actions are actually supporting, then you're doing a disservice to your movement. You're not promoting that movement. You're not moving it forward. When you have hundreds or thousands of people that are being arrested for the sake of illustrating a point, you have hundreds and thousands of people who are also posting bail, who are paying fines, who are contributing to the support of the police state. And so when we start thinking strategically about how we want to move forward, we have to be thinking strategically about that. Are we really trying to move the movement forward? Or are we simply wanting to have something that we can talk about that we did in our lifetimes? Because at the end of my life, I want to say more to my grandchildren than I was arrested 40 times. I want to tell them that I was able to actually create some type of change. I think that this is kind of spills over from historic movements where this has been really effective. And I think that there are times, and there certainly have been times in history where this has been really effective. But the climate has dramatically changed, and the way that people are impacted by that has been minimized. We see people being arrested every single day. People barely bat an eye. And so I really want to dig into this a little bit deeper, and I'm hoping that you'll weigh in on this, Revere, to talk about when are the times when it might actually be effective to be arrested and to use that obstructionist form of action to move the cause forward.
Yeah, I think this is an important conversation, a critical conversation, Sherry, and I appreciate that you brought up the disparity in the approach of getting arrested, that not all of us can actually do it, and our movements tend to glorify it. Now, as you said, there is a theory and a strategy to the concept of arrests, and I'm going to dig into that a little bit, and then I'd like us to make sure we talk about the over 200 methods of nonviolent action, so that as we're discussing how getting arrested works and does not work, we're also keeping in mind all of the other ways that we can take action, ways that might be more strategic and effective in our particular circumstances of our movements. But getting back to arrests, so there are many reasons and ways to get arrested. First of all, there's a concept called civil disobedience. Now, civil disobedience is different than just getting arrested. People are arrested in the course of waging nonviolent struggle all the time. They can be arrested for blockading a train that's carrying, say, nuclear bombs or oil. And in that case, they're often being arrested for trespassing, right? And getting arrested in that case is an inevitable result of doing a different type of nonviolent action. They had to blockade the train. The police arrested them to clear the tracks. This is different than civil disobedience. Civil disobedience is disobeying an unjust law. And in that context, there are two ways that people have employed this tactic. One is as a personal moral choice, as in the case of Henry David Thoreau, who actually coined the term civil disobedience by refusing to pay a war tax, more or less. He was arrested for disobeying that law. This was a moral point he was making. Now, there is also the way that Gandhi used civil disobedience, which is mass non-cooperation with an unjust law to make it unenforceable by the weight of our total non-cooperation. One context we could use this today in is around our, say, free speech zones. By mass non-cooperating with this unjust law, we could make it unenforceable through our massive non-cooperation. It's quite a distinction in terms of how we use civil disobedience. Oftentimes in the U.S., we're using a symbolic act of civil disobedience, so getting arrested in front of the White House, for example. Oftentimes you get arrested in front of the White House, you get taken down to the police precinct, you're released within 30 minutes to a couple of hours. There is a minor fine and a rather routine legal proceeding. So as you can see, there are many dimensions to this concept of getting arrested, and we are often employing all of these tactics, all of these approaches, without much consciousness about what is the strategic value of them. So when we're talking about getting arrested, understanding why we're getting arrested, what is the purpose, and what is the impact is very important. Getting arrested in general is quite costly to a movement compared to other tactics that might also achieve the same goals or have an even greater impact. If the point is to make a symbolic point, is to catch people's attention, is to raise awareness about the cause, is to take a moral stance, you might want to use an act of protest and persuasion that is very flamboyant or dramatic or uses humor. And you might want to pair that with a wisely planned media campaign and strategy. One other dimension about getting arrested is that 100 years ago, like say during the early labor movement, a little less than 100 years ago, court trials were widely publicized and reported upon. People read about court trials avidly. They discussed them in the streets. The discussion of legal matters was a big deal. So like when we're talking about Eugene Debs going on trial, that's a whole different category than what, say, if I got arrested for something and went on trial. It's just a different scope of discourse and impact. Right now we have a corporatized media system that simply does not give us that kind of coverage for our arrests. So these are some of the conditions to consider when you're thinking about what tactics to use. So as you can see, there's a lot of different ways to use the tactic of arrests in the course of a nonviolent struggle, and it needs to be approached with wisdom, analysis, and consideration of whether it's the best use of your resources in your particular circumstances. We'll talk a little bit later on about the other 198 methods of nonviolent action, and let's just keep digging into this conversation.
Well, I just want to say one more thing about that is that I've been a party to some actions where, or I've been a participant in the planning stages of some actions where people were actually informed of the consequences of being arrested and the disruption that that may or may not cause to their lives, depending on the severity of the action that they were engaged in. And it was recommended that people of a certain subset within the group would be more favorable candidates for arrest than others. And just the fact that people are aware that there is a certain subset of the population that can participate in these types of actions with very little impact on their lives, people who have the resources and the ability and the support system to be able to be bailed out of jail, who are able to address whatever charges are being brought against them, who are no longer working, possibly retired. I often see retirees being one of the largest groups of people that are being arrested. And we have to recognize that there's an aspect of privilege to this. And if we want to be able to address privilege within our society, we have to really look honestly at all the ways that we're participating in privileged activity. And so when we start thinking about these things and thinking about the deeper implications of them, I think that it's really important to really cultivate understanding in the broader sense, which leads us to this whole concept of leadership. And I think that we have really moved forward in a lot of ways in regard to leadership. I know that when we have co-taught together, and I know that you teach this on your own, and now I teach this as well, this concept of leaderful rather than leadership, where you have real respect for the diversity of skill sets within your group, and you're able to devise your movement around a number of different areas that address a number of different characteristics and supports, these pillars of support for the system that you want to be able to move beyond. And so there are many ways that we can start looking at these things and addressing them, but we have to be willing to first be really honest with ourselves, because a lot of times people go out and they'll participate in something because they feel inspired. They want to be able to create change. But what ends up happening is they participate in something very short-term, very limited, without any long-term goals, and they just feel really good about themselves. And they come home and they feel really good about themselves, but nothing has changed. And so we have to really have honest conversations with ourselves about what are our intentions. Do we simply want to feel good, or do we want to create change? And oftentimes that's a difficult mirror to look in. And I understand that, because I was participating in a lot of activities where I felt really good and kind of self-righteous. And then I realized that I'm not really affecting change. And do I actually want to be able to create change in the world? Do I want to make this world a more equitable, humane, and just place for my children and grandchildren and all others who follow behind me? Or do I simply want to make myself feel good? And so these are the kinds of questions that if you really want to affect change, you have to be willing to ask yourself. And you have to be willing to look at them honestly, without a lot of emotion and ego identity attached to them, without digging your heels in about trying to justify why you're doing what you're doing. If you really want to affect change, you're going to be willing to ask yourself the tough questions. You're going to be willing to look at what you're doing to see if it's actually creating movement in the direction that you want it to create, or is what you're doing amplifying the police state? Is what you're doing supporting systems that you're hoping to move beyond? And when we look at the long-term implications of some of those things and how it's all entwined, like you said, it's all part of this one connected web. And we have to be willing to look at where did the threads of that web trace to, and how do we actually engage this process in a way that moves the thread in a direction that's weaving a new future for all of us. And so may not be a comfortable place to begin, but it's a really important place to begin. And so let's kind of switch gears just a slight bit here and talk about this idea of leadership versus leaderful, and about the necessity of identifying with multiple aspects and multiple skill sets within the movements that we're engaged in. Because when you have one leader, it's easy for you to target that leader and to eliminate them in some way. When that leader is gone, then the movement flounders. If you have a leaderful movement, then you have multiple individuals with multiple skill sets who are able to shift a direction on a dime and be able to keep the movement going forward despite the loss of any one individual.
And we'll be back after a quick break for a station ID and some of Diane Patterson's wonderful music. And now let's return to our program.
And so, Revere, I would love for you to talk a little bit about that. I love your murmuration example that you give and the teaching that you have around this particular area.
Yeah, it's a great conversation. And, you know, it's a pertinent one since we all went through Occupy, whether we're in the movements or not. And we heard a lot about the leaderless structure. Now, as those of us who are in the streets of Occupy found out pretty quickly, leaderless structures actually open up a vacuum, so to speak, whereby our dynamics of privilege and oppression tend to play out in their negative side. A person who, long prior to Occupy, really started questioning this idea of how do we do leadership in a way that creates equitable and just structures that empower collaborative and cooperative decision-making was Ella Baker. Ella Baker was very frustrated by the male-dominated leadership and hierarchies of the civil rights movement. And she actually left one organization in disgust over it and started doing a whole different way of organizing. So she started a trend that has been picked up not just by her, but it also comes from many other sources, indigenous organizing, Latino communities have a habit of this as well. We see it in other parts of the world, whereby leaderful structures are created, whereby many people are empowered not just to lead, not just to take command, but to actually work collaboratively through group processes to empower and engage all participants in the movement in coming up with ideas, in brainstorming, in understanding strategic wisdom, in creating strategies for change, in choosing tactics, in pinpointing what campaigns to work on when, in cultivating resources for the movement, in assessing when a movement needs to rest and when it needs to move forward. When you have many people working on these things together, you're tapping into the collective wisdom of a group, which goes by the old saying of two heads or more are better than one. You know, we very dramatically saw this problem of the charismatic leader with Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s assassination, and not to mention Malcolm X's assassination, John F. Kennedy, Robert F. Kennedy's assassination. Those deaths were a stark reminder of the importance of changing the way we do leadership and hierarchy in this country. Otpor in Serbia really questioned this deeply because Milosevic, the dictator, would actually kill and arrest known leaders of opposition groups to his regime. So they very deliberately came up with a structure that they called leaderless in their time, but actually used training and shared identity as a framework of understanding that created a leaderful movement. So this is a quest of mine, is to learn to greater and greater degrees how to empower leaderful movements, how to help build those shared decision-making processes. And most importantly, like we're doing today on Love and Revolution Radio, how to get the tools of strategic knowledge and wisdom into everyone's hands. I want to see 320 million Americans know what we're talking about today. Because when we all know how to plan, then we start to see strategic behaviors in our populace, in our movements, in our communities, and in ourselves. And we don't have to fight about who's going to be the leader, because we share a common understanding of how change is going to be made. Sherry, I'd be really curious to hear some of your thoughts.
Well, one of the things that I think is really important when we're starting to think about these activities that are associated with creating change is to think about what I talked about earlier, this interest convergence point, and to remember that everyone really believes that they're right. Everyone really believes in their cause, and that belief may be based on accurate information or misinformation. And the only way that you're going to be able to shift that is to understand how that individual who may be opposed to you came to their way of thinking, to be able to look at that objectively, to be able to try to really understand it empathically, to be able to stand in their shoes and think, if I had had the same experiences that led me to the same place and had been given the same information, would I have arrived at the same conclusion? And in order for us to be able to do that, we have to really start thinking about the people on the other side of the movement as human beings. And I heard this great analogy the other day. I was listening to a lecture by a spiritual teacher. I'll just go back to this great quote that I heard one time where they described a guru as G-U-R-U. And this person was talking about thinking about the mind like, you know, your crazy uncle. And so when we think about the things that come into our mind and all of these ideas that we have, all of these beliefs that we've adopted that may or may not be true when they're exposed to the light and to the full breadth of knowledge surrounding any particular issue, we have to have a willingness to look at that honestly and to really engage in this transformative process within ourselves that allows us to be the person capable of being in that place and time, so that we can find a point of interest where our beliefs and our ideas about the future converge, and then we can build on that particular area. And one of the exercises that I have people do in my workshops is to think about a time when you had to convince somebody that you love, somebody that's close to you, somebody that you care about, to either do something or to acquire something that they really wanted to do or have. So say you're a child and you really want to have a new Huffy bike with a banana seat. Or, you know, you want to be able to go on a solo fishing trip with your friends. Whatever it is that you had to convince somebody that you love, whether it was a parent or a spouse or a friend, how did you do it? How did you engage in that process with them? Think about what steps you had to take in order to get to the place where this began until you actually met with success. And to think about what were the things that were in your control? What skill sets did you have that were in your control as you were going through this process of trying to convince them? What were the things that were outside of your control? And start really mapping out the skills and influences that allowed you to move that forward. And so then you start thinking about the internal factors. You think about the external factors. And when you start looking at the issues that we're facing in that way, when you start looking at it as a negotiation of sorts, there are some things that are clearly not negotiable, that none of us are willing to negotiate on. But somewhere embedded in that issue is an interest that we can all agree on. And somewhere embedded within that issue is a path forward that we can all agree on. So how do we find that place? How do we allow ourselves to get to the place where we can actually engage the process of finding that out? There is a whole process that's involved in that, that really involves us being willing to engage in a transformational process within ourselves, because the paradigm of the past 17 centuries has been conquest, competition, condemnation, criticism, being able to conquer your enemy, being able to overthrow your enemy, being able to divide groups of people apart so that they're in manageable numbers so that you can control and manipulate and subjugate them. So how do we overcome that old line thinking that leads us to believe that everybody that opposes us initially is our enemy? And how do we come to that process and meet that process with a more love-based, heart-based intention that allows us the opportunity to be able to create these inroads that get us to the yes and place?
Well, Sherry, I'm going to be a little bit of a devil's advocate at this moment. It's just that right as far back as Sun Tzu's Art of War, one of the very first lines is know your enemy and know yourself, and you will win, right? So there's kind of my little cynical strategic side is it really understands that humanizing your opposition, not creating monsters out of them, humanizing them, it allows you to have the strategic wisdom and insight to make wise choices about how you're going to negotiate this conflict that you're in. How are you going to actually convince that other person to put down their sword, put down their weapon, put down their policy, put down their practice, their business concept? And how are you going to find ways to non-cooperate with them until they do? Because remember, the one very important part of nonviolent struggle for me is to acknowledge that we always have the right to refuse to cooperate with injustice. That if our opposition is not willing to make a change for justice, then it is not just our right, but our responsibility to find ways to withdraw participation from that system and to block and to intervene in that system's ability to continue to perpetuate its injustices. So just as a little side note for the listeners, to remember when we're looking at 198 methods of nonviolent struggle, and there are many more than that number, but those are the ones that were cataloged by Gene Sharp, that we have acts of protest and persuasion, where we withdraw our words, our thoughts, our beliefs, our public invisible consent, where we speak up against the injustice. But there are also acts of non-cooperation, where we remove our consent and cooperation and that of our friends and neighbors from the systems of injustice. These actions can include strikes, boycotts, sit-ins, slowdowns, work stoppages, and much more. There are also acts of intervention, where you get in the way of the system of injustice's ability to operate and acquire the resources that it needs to continue to perpetuate its injustice. Again, these types of actions can include blockades, shutdowns, mill-ins, wade-ins, acts of disruption, interruption, sometimes acts of civil disobedience, the organizing supplier boycotts, and much more. So remember how many different types of actions you can take to start to non-cooperate entirely with a system of injustice, to really make it clear to the problem that you're facing that it will not continue, either because your opposition changes or because you change.
I think that what comes to mind for me when you're saying all that is being a parent. And so when I think about all of the things that you're talking about as devil's advocate theories, they're really not opposed to what I was saying at all. That as a parent, I've had to make decisions where I have withdrawn my support for certain activities because of certain behaviors that were attached to that activity or certain other behaviors that needed to stop. There have been times when I have taken away resources when there were things that needed to change. There have been times when my children have stood in protest to an unjust ruling within the house. We were able to manage all of those things to find a way to be able to move forward together. There were changes that had to be made along the way. But my point is that we didn't have to villainize one another in order to do that. We didn't have to turn each other into demons in order to do that. We were able to stand our ground. We were able to have our needs and our requirements put forward in such a way that made a clear point. But we didn't have to crucify publicly the other in order to do that. I didn't put my daughter in the stocks in the center of town and say she's being punished for this particular behavior because. And I think that if we can negotiate these things within our individual lives, that we can negotiate these things in the external world in a different way. And yeah, going all the way back, these ideas of enemies and conquest and the other and separation, all of this illusory belief that we've been guided by has existed. But now we're hoping to shift into a new paradigm where we understand that we are all part of one connected system, that we are all the same, that you are me and I am you. And so we can't carry that old language forward with us if we hope to be able to create a new paradigm going forward. We can engage some of those same practices, but we have to do those from a place of heart-based, love-based wisdom.
I think that's so many great points, Sherry Mitchell, and this is why I love having this conversation with you. Nonviolence is normal. It's a very normal human behavior, and that's a really key point to understanding, again, why we want to be talking with everyone in our movements about how to wage these struggles. We have great ideas. Everyone has great ideas about how to change and transform the world, from Sherry's three-year-old who's not three anymore to Sherry herself, you know? We know this equation actually quite intimately as human beings. We should speak a little bit about the two hands of nonviolence, that we've spoken quite a bit about the what we like to call the obstructive hand or nonviolent direct action, but we haven't talked a whole lot about the constructive hand, the hand that creates new systems, the hand that builds the new, the hand that says yes and. So I'm going to let you talk a little bit about building new systems, but I'm going to make a brief note about constructive program, which is a phrase that Gandhi coined. We should all know that. It's a type of action that does build new systems, but specifically also engages as many people as possible, that these are tangible actions like spinning cotton or making salt that remove the reliance of the movement upon the oppressor. So they're building the self-reliance of the movement while lessening the dependency of the movement on the oppressor. They often are keystone issues that can unravel the whole system of injustice. Like as in the case of salt or spinning is actually an even better example, where they deprive the British Empire of 8% of their import taxations on British cloth. That's like a major financial issue going on, that they're withdrawing that money from the British Empire. So these constructive program is intimately related to the problem that you're facing, but it's also something constructive that we're doing in the world. And it really oftentimes actualizes those two hands of nonviolence together. The SALT campaign is a really interesting example of that, where they use both obstructive action and constructive action. And there's a really cool silver lining to constructive action, which is that you often mobilize parts of the populace who, for reasons of privilege or culture, or lack of privilege, have not been previously involved in the movement. Gandhi had been working on the British Empire for years, and the SALT campaign was the first campaign in 1930 that actually mobilized women in mass participation with Gandhi's self-rule movement to get rid of the British Empire. Sherry, what would you like to add to this conversation of building new systems and constructive programs?
So much. I have so much that I would like to add. I think that this is probably the most fundamental piece, that we have to understand that the equation that we've been operating under has been 80% obstructive and maybe 10% constructive, and maybe it's 40% obstructive, 40% deconstructive, and 10% constructive, and then 10% completely impotent. And so we have to be willing to look at the equation of how we're engaging this process of change, and to remember this fundamental energetic and spiritual truth that whatever it is that we feed grows. And so if all we're doing is we're feeding the things that we don't want to see, we can define and we can outline and we can highlight and we can critique and we can condemn what we do not want all day long. But if you ask somebody, okay, so what are the alternatives? How do we actually engage those alternatives and implement them in real ways? How do we move closer to the world that we want to inhabit and further away from this world that we have tired of, that we see the flaws within, that we understand is no longer where we want to be in a collectively conscious state? And so in order to be able to do that, we have to be willing to focus our energy on what we want to be able to build. And so we have to look at the equation of how we're doing our change work and flip that equation so that the majority of our energy is being invested in actually building the world that we want to be able to build. I believe I've told this story on the show previously, but one of the most beautiful stories that came out of the protests up in Rexton, in New Brunswick, and Elsiebuchtig was that one of the drivers of the thumper trucks actually went to the Mi'kmaq people that were there and the Maliseet people that were there protesting. And there had been incredible conflict and confrontation between these two groups. Actually, one of the drivers had hit somebody who was protesting, and it was really hostile, very volatile. And he came to them and he said, "I don't want to hurt you." And he cried and he said, "This is the only thing I know how to do. It's the only way I know how to support my family. If you would show me another way, I would do it because I don't want to hurt anybody." And so when you speak to the heart of the people that are just human beings engaged in employment about the destruction and the harm that is being done by their industry, and you try to help them understand, we're standing here because we love your children as much as we love our own. We want to have the water safe to drink for everyone, not just for us. And, you know, this is a moral and spiritual stand for humanity, not just for this small group of people. You speak to the hearts and the minds of those people, then you can create a shift within them. But that's only effective if they have something else to step into. And so as we're doing this work and we start thinking about what are the things that we want to be able to build and create, then we can, like you said, withdraw our support from those other systems. One of the things that I think is the greatest piece of amnesia that we have as human and spiritual beings is the understanding that we're powerful, because we have allowed people to assume power over us and to exercise that power over us through the manufacture of legal fiction. And so when we have people who are operating under this really self-sustained, self-governing, self-policing form of legal fiction on how the society is supposed to be structured and operating, then we don't need huge militaries. We're seeing this rise in militarism within our police forces because people are remembering that they're powerful. People are beginning to remember that this is a fiction. They're beginning to remember that we're all connected, that we're interrelated and interdependent on one another and with the rest of the natural world. And so one of the most powerful things that we can do is to disengage our power from this fictional system, and we can start creating the world that we want to inhabit. And we do that by actually building new systems that support collaboration, cooperation, communal ways of living. The only way that our humanoid species survived was to learn to cooperate, collaborate, and to live communally. It was necessary for protection and for the sharing of resources. We waste an incredible amount by living these individualized lives that spun out of the fiction of rugged individualism and frontier mentality that came along with conquest. And so we need to be able to change our way of thinking about these things and actually start building, actively building the type of world that we want to inhabit. One of the things that I think is really important to highlight is banning of farming and backyard gardening. Who knew that it would be such a revolutionary act just to garden and to farm? I mean, there are small things that we can do to start actually actively changing these oppressive systems that we've been living under.
Well, I think that's a really great point and a really tangible point to really make a very broad contextual understanding of this conversation about nonviolent struggle, which is that we know how to live together as human beings. We knew it for thousands and thousands and thousands of years. And we've gone on this relatively brief time-based detour in human history, which is incredibly destructive and terribly dysfunctional. And the revolution, the love revolution, is actually rejecting that whole system of conquest, colonization, domination, separation, hatred, and division, and reconnecting and participating in systems of caring, loving, supporting, and nurturing one another. I don't care what any of the names for those systems are. I care what their function is. And we know those systems. Every one of our culture knows those systems. We have people talking about the commons here on Love and Revolution Radio. The commons is a name for that system that has other names in indigenous traditions and comes out of a European-based tradition. So you need to know your history, you need to know your stories, you need to know the dark side, the light side, the innovative side, the old side, the new side. And you need to know this knowledge of nonviolent struggle, how to wage struggles with heart, with courage, with strategy, and with compassion, so that we can transform from a system that's not working for anyone to what we've always known in our hearts to be true as human beings.
I think that sums it up beautifully, Rivera, that what we are focused on here on Love and Revolution Radio is about looking at how we engage those processes from the place of heart-based wisdom, which has been void, has been missing, has been hidden from us for so long in favor of these artificial fictional systems that have been created out of the imagination of man, and that it's time now for us to bring the kindness back into our humanity, human and kind. And we need to be able to remember how we are deeply connected and how we are dependent upon one another and upon the rest of the natural world for our survival here. So we have two choices right now. We can exit the planet, or we can learn to go back to what we know, which is that we are interrelated, that it is vital for us to care for one another. It's vital for us to remember that we belong to one another and to remember that we rely upon one another. No one is safe until we're all safe, as Dr. King said. And so as you move forward in your movements for change, we encourage you to remember yourself with the rest of creation and to take that as your grounding place for all of the movements that you have going forward.
I need you to be love, 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 love and revolution.
Thanks this week to my strategy-loving, heart-emanating co-host, Sherry Mitchell. Our theme song is Love and Revolution, with words and music by Diane Patterson and performed by Diane Patterson and Spirit Radio. You can find more of her music at www.dianepatterson.org.
And I'd also like to thank my amazing co-host, Rivera Sun. Rivera and I have been marveling at the fact that the stars aligned and brought us together and delivered us to this place where we're able to have these really illuminating and heartfelt and hopeful conversations with all of you. And I hope that you will continue to share these conversations with your friends. Remember that love is the revolution, and the way that love gets spread is by sharing it. I hope that you've enjoyed this conversation. If you enjoyed the things that I've shared on this show, you can also follow me on Facebook on my Sacred Instructions page, which can be found on the Love and Revolution webpage and on the podcast. Love and Revolution Radio is a weekly radio program, and your local radio station can broadcast it. Many radio stations across the country have been picking up the show, and we would like to thank our many supporters who are helping to make that possible. You can have Love and Revolution Radio broadcast in your area by your local radio station if you simply ask them. You can reach us via the Love and Revolution page on Rivera Sun's website, www.riverasun.com. And we are Love and Revolution Radio on Podomatic, Stitcher, and iTunes.
For Love and Revolution Radio, I'm Rivera Sun. Today we've discussed strategy for movements for change. And listeners, you should also know that we've collected some amazingly helpful links for further reading. So perhaps you'll check out our show notes and do some strategic nonviolent action homework by the time we talk to you next week. What if you knew?